this lecture was requested by you, and so it can go any direction that you steer it. So I will start, but I'm steerable.
Okay, thanks.
And there might be a part two to this lecture that Matt will do at some point, if we can find a time when you're in town and he's prepared.
Oh, great.
I think next week might be too early, and then we're not sure exactly when you'll be back.
I will look at it. I think a week afterwards I will be gone, but I will look at it.
All right, so what I'm going to talk about is n equal to supersymmetric SU2 gauge theory with no matter. That's a technical term, not an expression of disinterest.
I'm sorry, can I interrupt for a moment? Does this belong to anybody in this room?
No.
Following the first paper of Zeibergen-Witt on this subject. Which is from July 94. So we've talked, and 4D. So in the couple of lectures that I gave last quarter, we talked about supersymmetry and how various properties of supersymmetric theories are reflected in geometry. And I did the case of 8 supercharges in some detail, and this is 8 supercharges. So it's in that same context. But now we want to look at an actual physical theory and see what our clever friend Zeibergen-Witt did with it. So the first point, which I did cover last time, is the n equal 2 multiplets. So remember that n equal 2 supersymmetry is not the minimal supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. It has twice the minimal amount of supersymmetry. There is description of the possible representations of that supersymmetry algebra. And if you look at the representations which only involve particles whose quote-unquote spin is less than or equal to 1, which are the ones relevant for field theory rather than gravity theories, then there are basically 2 kinds of multiplets. There are some small variations which I won't discuss, but one of them is called the n equal 2 chiral multiplet. It's really called the n equal 2 vector multiplet, even though these guys call it the chiral multiplet. The n equal 2 vector, and that has a gauge field, a mu. So it's a gauge field, so it's transforming like a one form, and in typical physicist fashion, we indicate that it's a one form by using a single superscript, a subscript, to talk about the components. 2 Weyl fermions, lambda and psi, and a scalar, phi. And these all transform in the adjoint representation of whatever gauge group G we're discussing. So if you have a, it's supposed to be a compact group, but then promoted to gauge symmetries by allowing it to act independently at each point of space-time. If you happen to use a reducible group, then you probably would label these fields according to which group you had. But implicitly in here is that they are of a size that matches the dimension of the adjoint representation. So they're acted upon by the adjoint representation. So even though we're writing just one A phi, A mu, rather, in fact, it's an entire matrix full of A mu's. And in my case, in the case we're studying today, G will be SU2.
Dave, I'm rather confused. You said there's no matter. So now you have 2 fermions here.
So when I say there's no, I guess what I'm going to say is that there's no hypermultiple matter.
Okay.
Indeed, when regarded as an n equal 1 theory or even as a non-supersymmetric theory, there is matter in this theory. But the this multiple is regarded as being sort of governed by the gauge field, and the other n equal 2 multiplet, which is called the n equal 2 hypermultiplet, is governed by a pair of complex scalars, or if you like, one quaternionic scalar. And so that's seen as the matter, whereas this is seen as the gauge, right? And in fact, these, if they were present, just for completeness, I'm writing it down, but if they were present, they should transform under some specified representation of the group G.
Oh, I see.
But in fact, the whole reason there's a story about Zweig-Witten theory is because there is this scalar in the multiplet, and implicitly there always have to be fermions as well, which is what in ordinary physics we think of as providing the matter. So there's a little bit of matter just because you're forced to have it with a gauge field, in, with this much supersymmetry.
But would that cause trouble when you talk about unitarity, like the statistics? Well, I'm just thinking, you know, it's really bosonic, right? Because they're all adjoint repetition of the gauge group. And if you treat them as fermions.
Well, these are fermions transforming in the, under the adjoint representation of the gauge group. So each of these has a gauge index as well, right? Which that tells you how you act on it, but you, it's basically a whole collection of Lyell fermions, one per basis element of the, of the adjoint representation.
Probably I don't understand, you know, what I mean by fermion. So I'm thinking there should be a spinner bundle. Those would be sections of that spinner bundle.
Indeed, they are.
Okay.
So that has to do with space-time symmetry.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So now, in addition to space-time symmetry, I have this local symmetry, the gauge symmetry. Mm-hmm. I'm describing it in terms of a compact group, but as I just said, we're making that group act independently point by point in space-time. So the gauge group is actually something like g-valued functions on space-time, right? And so then at each point, I can make the corresponding group element act on the fiber of the spinner bundle.
Okay.
Or I should say some copies of the fiber of the spinner bundle. So the n equal 2 hypermultiplet has it has two Lyell fermions. Called psi q and psi dagger q tilde. Okay, I'm not really going to explain or try to explain some of this crazy notation that's used in this literature. So it has two scalars, and these are complex scalars in both cases. It has two complex scalars, Q and Q tilde dagger. And these should transform, if they were present, in a representation of G. Not necessarily the adjoint representation. You could add additional adjoint matter, but you could add fundamental matter, that whatever you wanted to. And I guess I'll just mention, because I did talk a little bit about the n equal 1 multiplets, in n equal 1 terms, an n equal 2 vector is comprised of an n equal 1 vector plus an n equal 1 chiral, and an n equal 2 hyper is an n equal 1, 2 n equal 1 chiral. Yeah, so if one were completely consistent about language, one would always call this a vector multiplet. And observe that this is a single word, and so multiplet should never be omitted from it, but that's not what people do. They talk about vectors and hypers. So they always have to remember what they're talking about. So there are classical symmetries of these theories. So there's an SU2 classical symmetry, and there's a U1 classical symmetry. And these are symmetries which don't commute with the action of the supersymmetry algebra, and and by convention they're called R symmetries. So I don't know where the name R comes from, but that's what they're doing. So they can act on the different components of a multiplet in different ways. So for example, SU2R acts on the pair of a Q and a Q tilde dagger. And U1R acts on phi. Let's see. With some charge, sorry. Didn't write it down. Anyway, it somehow acts on phi, and it acts differently on the fermions of the theory than it acts on the bosonic fields in the theory. So differently on fermions. Well, here you can already see, if it's acting on this pair, it's mixing them up. They were supposed to be preserved by the supersymmetry representation. So these have different actions on fermions. Now, these are global symmetries, so they're not required to be symmetries of the quantum theory. And in fact, the U1R is almost always, and it certainly will be true for the case that we're doing today, anomalous. That means that there is an obstruction to defining an appropriate section of the corresponding bundle of Dirac operators on the fermions, which is compatible with the action of U1R. And typically, when there's an anomaly like that, it can break the symmetry in the quantum theory to the anomaly-free subgroup. So we have some action on this attempted space of Dirac operator bundles, and it doesn't work completely, but it can work on a subgroup, which in this case would be a finite subgroup. So if you have the theory just a sort of known fact, if you have SUNC, so we're doing SU2, if you have G equals SUNC and NF fundamental hypermultiplets, so by that I mean the NC dimensional complex representation, then the anomaly-free subgroup. Okay, so the story of these anomalies and how you calculate them and what conclusions you draw is a whole lecture of its own, but the anomaly-free subgroup turns out to be a cyclic subgroup of order 4nc minus 2nf. So you can hope for, you should expect symmetry of that sort of the quantum theory, even though the U1 symmetry is broken in the quantum theory.
So, you said anomaly free. Is the same thing as you spontaneously break the symmetry down to this finite group?
It's not spontaneous symmetry breaking. The U1R never holds in the quantum theory. So, in the classical limit of the theory, the U1R is restored. But in any quantum version of the theory, it's broken down to the second subgroup.
But then this Z is coming from SUA or from the U1? This Z is just...
This Z is inside of U1R.
Inside of U1R. So something left over.
And I should say that this is anomaly free. This is not about the gauge theory. So in the gauge theory, we're going to see that at low energy, the SU2 gauge group is broken to a U1. That's a different story. That's a symmetry breaking story. These are not local symmetries. They don't vary from point to point. These are global symmetries of the story. And you expect to find these global symmetries typically when you have non-minimal supersymmetry, because having non-minimal supersymmetry sort of invites the possibility of somehow permuting the fermions in the super algebra.
So if I understand correctly, it's the quantization process to break down U1 to this cyclic group.
Exactly. So, you know, philosophically, in my opinion, we shouldn't talk about quantization. We should talk about classicalization. So quantum theories are the interesting ones, and they have classical limits. And of course, the classical limits are more easily accessible to us. And so we typically learn about the classical theory first. But the quantization is an art, not a science, as people say. And actually, if you know quantum theory, finding the classical limit is an important feature of it. So I
think you just claim you have a higher form of life. You start with a quantum life, you want to go down. I think we see a classical life.
Something like that. Although, look, classical life is great. It's richer because it has this extra symmetry, which the quantum life doesn't have. So.
I like quantum. It's a smaller group. It's this rich.
The quantum theory tends to be richer than the classical theory, although you can have, you know, symmetry, global symmetry enhancements in the classical theory. The story of anomalies and the role that they play really started in the 60s with trying to understand the role of the pion in particle theory. Well, I saw the physics grad students all nodding because they all know that story.
Yeah, I heard a series of lectures of Nathan nodding, and I said, you know, we have three words in the title: symmetry, duality, and anomaly. Mm. And I told him, I said, you know, I think symmetry, duality are good things, and anomaly is bad things. And then he tried to convince me I'm wrong. They're all good.
they are because they all provide constraints. So the fact that the symmetry is anomalous is not fatal to the quantum theory in this particular case. So there's an anomalous symmetry. It happens to have an anomaly-free subgroup. It might not have had an anomaly-free subgroup, right? On the other hand, if you have an anomaly of a gauge symmetry, then the theory that's fatal for the theory because in a gauge theory, the only physically measurable quantities are supposed to be the gauge invariant ones. It doesn't make sense to talk about a gauge theory unless you have an actual action by the gauge group. All right. So there's a classical potential. For this n equal 2 theory, again with the one without matter, which looks like the potential on the scalar component of the vector multiplet. I'm sorry, I've erased my multiplets, but that's the scalar component of the vector multiplet, and it has the coupling constant of the theory, G is the coupling constant. And then it says trace of the commutant of phi phi dagger squared. So those are matrix valued. So we're taking one of them, we're taking its formal conjugate transpose, taking the commutant of those, and that's the potential function. Sorry, I shouldn't change type of phi. So V of phi equals zero can happen if phi and phi dagger commute. So we don't need them to vanish. We just need them to commute. And that leads to an entire space of solutions, which physicists might call vacuum degeneracy. You see, a lot of physical theories have the following property, that there's some fields and then a kinetic term and some potential energy, and if you minimize the potential energy, that should tell you what the vacuum state of the theory is. I'm speaking of the classical theory right now. And typically you expect the vacuum to be unique. Or if it's not unique, you could have, you know, potentials like this where there are two possible vacuum states, and then there are fun stories like the quantum tunneling from one classical vacuum to another, things of that sort. To have an entire continuous manifold full of solutions is not a very expected thing in physical theories. Those sorts of things were problematic when people were first studying gauge theories, because it looked like you had spaces of solutions which depended on parameters, but then it was realized that if you took the gauge equivalents into account, that typically then you only had one solution in some nice non-supersymmetric gauge theory. So this vacuum degeneracy, however, is a feature, at least of the classical theories, and it also turns out to be a feature of the quantum theories. And the way we can parameterize this is, so again, for G equals SU2, then phi is conjugate to something of the form, half times a scalar times this matrix. That's not even in S, sorry, it's an adjoint, it's adjoint. So it's conjugate to something like that, its claim. I should have said, when I said adjoint, that phi takes values in the algebra. Little SU2. Right, so there it's trace condition, and I can diagonalize. If it commutes with its dagger, I can diagonalize. And so we'll use A. We'll use U, which is 1/2 A squared, which can be identified with the trace of phi squared, is the natural parameter.
So, Dave, I think you already said so, but I just want to confirm. So the way you guys think is for different A's, the all parameters give you the same field. It's just a different way to parameterize. Is that true? You know, this whole, you know, doesn't matter which A you take, it's the same theory.
So if we fix the gauge coupling, then we have a parameter.
And they're all the same theory, all the different theories.
If we change the parameter, we can compensate for that change by changing the gauge coupling. So it looks like the same theory, but at different gauge couplings.
Oh, so this A is also a function of G.
It's not, but both A, I mean, so now it, phi is conjugate to this, so I would put, you know, I'll get in here, that essentially, in that form, I'll essentially get 1/2 A squared. So I've got an A squared and I've got a G squared. Okay. So, yes, the theories at different values are very similar, but they differ essentially by the strength of the coupling. I mean, you could relabel things so that you can either use the BEV of the adjoint valued scalar or else the gauge coupling.
I know you eventually want to say that A is labeled a low energy effective theory, right? So this will be very different from you go back to the high energy theory.
That's correct. So I'm sort of analyzing vacuum solutions, and then I'm about to remark that if A is not zero, then SU2 is broken by this choice to the commutant of my matrix half A, 1, 0, minus 0, minus 1. The A is irrelevant for that, which is U1. So at low energy, I'll use the fact that I'm somewhere near a vacuum solution. I can talk fluctuations around this vacuum solution and treat U1 as the effective gauge symmetry instead of SU2. So that's sort of the classical story, and the question is what sorts of quantum modifications, I think I'm not going to say the quantum modifications quite yet. Why did I square A? I want to observe that the Weyl group of SU2 took A to minus A. And so if I want something which is appropriately invariant, then I really should be using the square. So, and that's a well-known function on the adjoint representation, which is invariant under the conjugation, right? You can always take traces of powers of phi. The trace of the first power of phi, by definition, is zero. Traces of higher powers of phi for unitary theories, SU theories, are good invariants for the conjugate action on the adjoint representation. So now to talk about the low energy effective action, I'm going to treat A as if it were a field in its own right. So this is actually one of Seiberg's favorite things to do, promote the parameter A to a field. Now, in doing so, I have to make it into a into an n equal 2 multiplet. And in fact, we're going to let A be the n equal 2 vector multiplet. Whose lowest, whose scalar component is little a. I fibbed three boards ago when I told you that the scalar and the vector is complex. The scalar is real, sorry about that. It's complexified by a theta angle, which we're coming to. But I misspoke when I said that the scalar in the vector multiplet was complex. Here it's real. It's a real parameter, but it's about to be complexified by the theta angle. So how am I going to write the theory, the low energy theory? So the terms in the supersymmetric low energy theory involve, whether it's classical or quantum, a holomorphic function of A of the multiplet capital A. What I mean by that is a holomorphic function has a series expansion, and we'll substitute this into the series. And if I'm substituting in fermions, then I can't take powers to be very high. When I'm substituting in vectors, I'm using the group somehow to multiply them, probably taking a trace. And when I'm substituting in the scalar, then I use the power series. And as we'll see, the scalar gets naturally complexified, and we'll treat that as a function of a complex variable for the most part. It's a holomorphic function, involves a holomorphic function of phi, and in n equal 1 language, yeah, let me pause and say that we're interested in these n equal 2 theories, but we don't have a superspace formulation for n equal 2 theories, so we don't have a way of writing down those components from n equal 2, completing them in a natural way to components that will behave components that will have a linear and closed relation, representation of the supersymmetry. But if I decompose my n equal 2 into n equal 1 things, I can write things in terms of superfields and utilize the fact that I've got linearly acting supersymmetry on the configuration space in the n equal 1 terms. And then you have to make a separate check that the additional supersymmetry that's required by n equal 2 is satisfied by what you're looking at. So in n equal 1 language, the Lagrangian is 1 over 4 pi times, so Lagrangians in N equal 1 theories terms are two basic types. You can either integrate over all four fermions, and the typical thing we'll integrate in that case in terms of this holomorphic function is the holomorphic partial of that function times a bar, or you can do some integrals which are just over two of the fermions, and there I take two derivatives of my holomorphic function, and I also have to put in some other fields W, which are also associated to this thing. Okay, Matt, an hour ago I said, what is W? And you found it, and now I can't find it. Do you remember?
I think W was the n equals 1 vector multiplied part of the n equals 2 vector.
Okay, very good. Right, so we had to break up capital A into its various component, n equal 1 component pieces, and WA was the vector piece. Okay, so just to satisfy n equal 2 supersymmetry, you need to have a Lagrangian taking that form. When you do some of these theta integrals, then you end up with a term like this popping out. So that's the reason that this is the right sort of thing. I didn't write a gauge coupling in there. I'm not quite sure why. That's the basic shape of the integrals that you have to take. And I forgot to put imaginary part right here, which is important. Typically one's often writes plus complex conjugate or something like that because those are holomorphic quantities, but we want a real Lagrangian. So Seiberg and Witten's goal was to kind of figure out what behavior this function f of a would have, which describes the theory.
So you mentioned that you want, you know, this A is the real part, and there is an imaginary part, which is theta.
Yeah.
And so always, you know, people use the word, use the letter tau to represent that variable. The same as your A, or is it different?
No, it's coming. Tau is coming in just a second. So the structure of the theory is encoded in basically this function f of A. And we've got a simple form of f of A, which we're starting out with. The simple form involves tau, which I haven't said the identity of yet, so let me do this, the tau first. The classical version involves tau, but then we want a quantum version which matches various properties that one can argue the quantum theory has to have. That the enumeration of the properties comes from physical considerations, but then there's a mathematical problem of, can you find a function with the right properties? And under one assumption, sort of simplifying assumption, the function, Seiberg and Witten showed that the function is unique and is determined by this thing that has since become called the Seiberg-Witten curve. So, I guess it's time to talk about tau. So tau, classical, is the theta angle of the theory plus I times 4 pi over g squared. So I wrote down a term that involved 1 over g squared times the trace of phi dagger squared. But in four-dimensional theories, there's a possibility of including also a topological term. So that's a little more familiar when you're writing the gauge theories just in terms of gauge fields instead of worrying about this scalar field that I've been discussing. But the quantity, which is always looked at, is this particular complex quantity, which serves to pair up terms involving f wedge F bar, which are the terms that, and the trace phi dagger that I wrote down was a sort of supersymmetric partner of the familiar F wedge F bar term from the curvature of the vector field. So I have trace of F wedge F bar, and then I have a trace of F wedge F term, typically in four dimensions, which also gets a potential parameter, and which is known as the theta angle. That's the one that's topological in the sense that it doesn't depend on space-time. It depends on something about the topology of the solution to the field equations that you're looking at. Right. So, as I mentioned in the very first lecture, when we have n equal to when we have n equal 1 supersymmetry, and we have scalars in the n equal 1 theory, then there is a natural Kähler potential for the metric on the space of scalars. Okay. When I told you a few minutes ago that I was wrong about the scalar being real, actually I was wrong when I corrected myself. I was right the first time. Sorry about that. Scalar is complex. The coupling constant is real, and I've just managed to complexify it. But the scalar is complex, and the reason it's complex is that when you decompose the n equal 2 vector into n equal 1 multiplets, you get a scalar from the chiral multiplet that's one of the components. Okay, that's why. In fact, even with n equal 1, we have Kähler moduli spaces for these particular fields, and they have a Kähler potential, which you read off of the Lagrangian as the Kähler potential looks like the imaginary part of this partial F with respect to A times A bar, or the metric itself in some concrete form looks like the imaginary part of a second derivative of the holomorphic function now restricted to the complex scalar itself times dA dA bar. So that's the Kähler metric on the space of vacuum. And as I say, we've promoted the parameter to a field, so we're now considering a combined theory where that field is also allowed to fluctuate, essentially, and then this n equal 1 result about it having to have a Kähler metric gets invoked. So when I said everything was going to be encoded in terms of a holomorphic function, out of that holomorphic function, I build a non-holomorphic function, which serves as the Kähler potential for the metric. That's one of the ingredients here. So let's just mention some features of the quantum theory. Let's kind of dictate the rest of what happens. One is if A is big, the theory is asymptotically free. And so we can think of it as being weakly coupled. Moreover, the vacuum degeneracy cannot be removed quantum mechanically. Since n equal 2 supersymmetry does not permit an n equal 1 superpotential. So that sentence only makes sense to people who've studied these supersymmetric theories. There are The multiplet structure for n equal 1 is less constrained, and there are additional terms, in addition to the one that I just wrote down, for the n equal 2 theories. And in particular, there's a thing called the superpotential, which comes with a d2 theta integral in n equal 1 theories. And the equations of motion associated to the superpotential will typically put you at some critical point of a function on this degeneracy locus of the moduli. But we don't have a superpotential in n equal 2, so we cannot remove the vacuum degeneracy in that way. So having found it classically, we're expecting it to continue quantum mechanically. We're expecting a weakly coupled theory at large values of A, so that gives us some asymptotic information. And the classical value of F is read off from the Lagrangian that I first wrote down. So the one I most recently wrote down was the general form of the n equal 2 theory in n equal 1 language, but if you looked at the original classical one and included the topological term, you would simply find f of a to be tau classical times a squared. So a is now the superfield that represents this guy, and that's the only term that's allowed classically, where the tau parameter that's appearing there includes the gauge coupling as well as the theta angle for the theta term. So they always want to set theta equal 0, they say. Well, later they don't, so I'm going to ignore the sentence. Right. And so if you want to find a kind of invariant way of reading off tau, you can say that tau depends on A by just taking the second partial of this so-called prepotential. I think I haven't named it yet, but script F is called the prepotential. Second partial of F with respect to the prepotential. And so when I have a function of a superfield and I want to know what value it takes on the scalar, I can just substitute in the scalar. That's what the shift in from uppercase to lowercase meant there. And here, at the classical level, I could just get a constant value of tau by taking the second partial. So that is going to be the effective coupling in the theory more generally. We would expect if we expand it out and we're starting out quadratic and have some corrections that we can learn about the appropriate thing to put in the coupling by evaluating this at the particular value that we're doing the expansion of, right? So f is an analytic function, so that's okay. And when we get more complicated f's that solve all of the constraints, then we'll pull out a tau function just by this second partial idea.
Talk about
what?
You will talk about SL2Z.
Yes. So in fact, we'll sort of get to that now, but let me just mention that you can calculate F by renormalization methods and look for a one-loop term. And you find a one-loop term for F, which is scale-dependent. That looks like this, where lambda is the dynamical scale. Right, so we have the space of physical theories. The renormalization procedure says that you make an approximation where you only consider momentum within a certain range, and then you observe how the theory behaves in response to changes in that momentum cutoff. The momentum cutoff is essentially the dynamical scale, what I'm speaking of here. Analyze that guy. There are in principle, one loop, two loop, three loop contributions, but the n equal two supersymmetry implies that this computation is one loop exact. So you don't have to do higher loop contributions. And you find this running version of the function in this general form. Potentially perturbative contributions, which look like powers of lambda over A multiplying A squared with coefficients that we don't really know so well. These are instanton contributions in the theory. And one can make calculations that show that F1 is not equal to zero, and lots more has been done about this form of the expansion later. Okay, so how does the duality show up in this story? The duality shows up in the with the observation that we've put the moduli space effectively in this form, the metric on the moduli space effectively in this form. It's the imaginary part of tau of A dA dA bar. Right? I was expressing things in terms of second partial derivative when I wrote down the Kähler potential. And moreover, for large absolute value of A, tau of A should behave like the natural log of A squared over lambda squared for some scale lambda. I really don't know why it says plus 3 there, but that's what it says, over pi. And the key thing that I want to derive from that is the fact that this is a multi-valued function, but it has an imaginary part that's single-valued and positive. Okay, so this is multi-valued. Moreover, it can't be positive definite. So tau of A is multivalued, that's one point. This ds squared is not positive definite for all A, because if it were, it would essentially give you it would violate the maximum principle. It's the imaginary part of tau of some harmonic function. So it would violate the maximum principle. And that means that there has to be, this was a local description in a neighborhood of tau classical. So there have to be other local descriptions for the metric on this moduli space. And the hint for finding the other local descriptions is to introduce A sub D, D for duality. So we're kind of assuming that we know what the theory is when we write A sub D is the partial of F with respect to A. And in those terms, ds squared just looks like the imaginary part of dA sub D dA bar. Or otherwise put, minus I over 2 dA sub D dA bar minus dA dA sub D bar. Probably I should have wedge products in this place. Oh, no, sorry. This is not the Kähler form. This is the actual metric, so I don't need the wedge products. This idea that instead of writing it as imaginary part of tau A, dA, dA bar, you sort of pick out the tau A by this other means using first derivative instead of second is the idea which makes everything go. So the observation that they made is that the switching of A and AD, or more precisely, the switching of A and minus AD, gives another description of the same theory. So I should point out that we already have the possibility of replacing AD by AD plus a multiple of A and A left alone. This leaves the theory invariant. Certainly leaves the parametric invariant. So that one gets interpreted as an application of a matrix 1B01 to the pair A, D, and A. And the observation that you would potentially get another description of the same theory by switching these, well, they carefully analyze what the physical effect of doing that swap would be, and it essentially, so it's a form of what's known as Montonin-Olive duality, and it's essentially an electric-magnetic duality. So changing which one you call A and which one you call AD changes, so I'm working in this effective theory now, which is a U1 theory. So we have electrically charged particles, but we can also talk about magnetically charged objects in that theory. And those magnetically charged objects couple to AD in the same way that the electrically charged objects couple to A. So this notion of electric-magnetic duality had been around a lot in physics. Montonin and Olive had tried to describe it as a fundamental property of non-supersymmetric gauge theories, and it turned out not to be quite right. Here, it's not really a symmetry of the theory. It's a way of mapping a theory that involves one set of degrees of freedom, namely the electric variables, to a theory which involves another set of degrees of freedom, the magnetic variables, and they're linked by this great superpotential function, whose identity we don't quite know yet, but there has to be a function like that, and it should be able to describe what's happening in all of the A space, the little A space, whatever that is. So this turns out to be an action of 0, 1, minus 1, 0 on AD, A. And the two of those together generate SL2R. So in principle, there seems to be an SL2R symmetry, a duality symmetry, described here. Now, I'm running out of time for today. What I will tell you is that SL2R actually is broken to SL2Z by, this breaking is by BPS particles. So a physical feature of these theories is that they have to have massive particles that obey a certain, transform in a certain extension of the supersymmetry algebra, a central extension of the supersymmetry algebra, and the mass is determined by the properties of that central extension. And then the key thing about the central extension property is that it itself, well, let me just say what the... there's this so-called central charge for the central extension, which depends on where we are in the moduli space, and turns out to be a linear combination of the naive electric and magnetic charges. So you kind of measure naive electric and magnetic charges, and then you take this complex combination of those charges, and the coefficients are A and AD. And that charge lattice with those coefficients has to be preserved somehow, and the necessity of preserving that possible lattice of BPS charges is what leads us to conclude that we can't shift AD by an arbitrary number of A's, we can only shift it by an integer number of A's, and then this lattice is preserved in some nice way. Although the role of electric and magnetic is switched by the action of what's often called capital S, that 0, 1, minus 1, 0 matrix there. So that sort of gave the SL2Z symmetry. We've already argued that So there might be some singularity at the origin where we have light electric particles. This is where A is going to zero. And something has to be happening at infinity, which is probably where AD equals going to zero, light magnetic particles. And A is varying over a Riemann sphere of some kind, right? I put in the behavior at infinity. That's where we could use this asymptotic freedom analysis so that we can understand what's happening in some approximation near A equals infinity. But now the whole point of the duality is that we would like the duality transformation to enable us to give a better description of the physical properties near AD equals zero, where AD becomes the fundamental variable and A becomes the dependent variable. So you'd have to have a different function f, but this is a Legendre transform of the function. It's not hard to figure out what those functions are. And the remaining question is what can happen in between. And let's see, one thing I need to point out is that we definitely have this A goes to minus A effect, right? That was the action of the Weyl group of the SE2 gauge group. So we really wanted to express things in terms of A squared. Here I'm writing in terms of A, but you could rewrite the plane in terms of U. And if you leave it in terms of A for a second, you argue that if there was only a singularity at zero and infinity, then there wouldn't be the multi-valuedness that the I gave an argument for multi-valuedness based on the asymptotic behavior. There would not be the multi-valuedness of the function in that case. So to get multi-valuedness, I need at least another singularity. And in the A-plane, minus that singularity has to be present as well. So the minimum requirement to meet all the sort of boundary conditions on this is four singularities and an SL2Z symmetry. And everything's analytic other than that. And also invariance under this A goes to minus A in some appropriate sense. And Zeiberg and Witten then show that there's just one mathematical solution to that, which is somehow given by periods of a funny differential, the Zeiberg-Witten differential, on an elliptic curve of some appropriate kind, where the tau turns out to be the tau of the elliptic curve in question. Anyway, I rushed the end deliberately so that I could sort of finish a story, but maybe we can hear more details of that story on another occasion. I'll stop there.
So can you identify the in the standard Seinberg-Witten equation? There's an A, there's a psi, there's a spinner, there's a...
Yes.
So it come out of this story or something? Just how do we get the others, the set of variable A, psi, from this discussion?
So at the end of the day, A is going to be A and A dual are going to be sections of appropriate bundles. Over this space, and however they're transforming under the SL2Z, the spinners have to be transforming in a similar way. Yeah. So you could take a two-parameter space of spinners, also transforming like this, and in other words, the set of spinners has a little bit of internal structure to it. Of course, they're also just sections of a spinner bundle on space time at the same time.
But then what's the U1 then? There's, the Seinberg-Witten equation has two variables, right? There's a U1 connection, and then there's the spinner. So you're talking about the spinner, right?
The U1 is the U1 gauge group.
So it's in the original.
Right, we wanted stuff which, so we originally had spinners valued in the adjoint representation of SU2, and we had the action of the entire SU2. That has now been broken down to the commutant of the particular matrix that we studied, right? Whose eigenvalue was A, essentially, which is why we labeled it with A. And so that U1 is still acting in that way on the adjoint valued spinners.
I see. So it's the leftover on this.
That's right.
Plus one, minus one matrix, the sigma Z matrix. Yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay. Okay, maybe I will ask Stacey, I heard, you know, Witten said this whole thing has to do with the quark confinement. I don't see anything about confinement. I read an interview of him. He said, you know, he started a career with a failure. He couldn't solve the confinement problem. And eventually he made a little bit of progress by doing this centrifugal Witten theory. And I don't know how this can be related to confinement, which is a SU2 theory. But, you know, it's not something, I just, you know, curious, you know. He said, you know, he made a little bit of a progress on the problem, which is this whole centrifugal Witten story.
Right.
That's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in four manifolds,
right.
But still,
so,
I'm just curious.
So today, I was not including quarks at all.
Okay, but you can't.
In paper number one, they did not include quarks. In paper number two, they talked about a small amount of matter, and how the story is affected by a small amount of matter.
Okay, maybe that's
so. I in the language I was using today, I don't have a way to address the quark confinement question. Okay. Any more questions for the speaker?